This is Radio Freethinker, episode 65.
Radio Freethinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking. Right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. My name is Ethan, your freethinking historian and executive director of CFI Vancouver.
And this is Don, your political science philosopher.
This is Rob, cognitive psychologist and ultimate foodie.
This is Daniel, president of the UBC Freethinkers Club.
So gentlemen, how was your week?
My week was quite good, actually. I got work done, and I got to relax, and nothing blew up this week. I've had electronics blow up me every week so far for the last couple of months, and this week, knock on wood, yes, I can be pseudo-superstitious, it's not going to happen next week. So, other than that, yeah, it was pretty good.
I don't think Daniel was so lucky.
No.
Just before the show, something horrible happened to his Mac.
It's fine. It's just slightly dented.
Actually, this weekend I went to the Eat Vancouver convention down the new convention center, which they built beside the Olympic torch. It's this huge yearly convention about food and all things related, and it was a lot of fun.
Did you eat a lot of food?
I ate so many different foods. I mean, like, you get in there and you can buy these food tickets, and you bring them all around the festival, and everyone is offering something in exchange for a couple of the tickets. And the tickets are actually surprisingly cheap. Like, you can get quite a lot of food for very little money at these festivals. And it's all, like, the chefs themselves are there presenting their favorite or personal menus, tasting menus from all the best restaurants around Vancouver. I had the misfortune of arriving just around the lunch rush, so it was absolutely packed with people. You couldn't find seating. You couldn't find space to stand, let alone seating.
I went to one of these Eat festivals a few years back, and I was so disappointed. I went there, and I saw this presentation by Rob Feeney, and this is when he was at the height of his popularity. And he sat there, and he was making this, like, the $50 hamburger type thing, right? Oh, it looks so good. And there was, like, 50 people in the audience, and he made 3 for samples. And we were so disappointed. We figured, you knew thousands of people were going to show up. You should have thought ahead about this. So after a small riot, and these 3 people who did get them... It was quite interesting. A lot of people selling stuff there that seemed really bizarre, you know, Jamaican hot spice and stuff like that.
Yeah, actually, there was also a little section for international food, and one booth had freshly ground spices used in Indian cuisine, and you could go around and sample them all and smell them and see how they're ground, and it was amazing.
So how many things were there claiming to purify your liver and cleanse your stuff?
That's actually something I was going to bring up. There was a lot of BS at this festival. Stuff that, like, I don't even understand why it was at the Eat Vancouver Festival. First of all, there were so many different chiropractors, people selling, like, little vials of stuff that they said, you know, you didn't have to ingest. They're just like, okay, why are you at the Eat Vancouver Festival?
It seems like pretty much any festival that goes on in Vancouver, you get out all of these companies that I swear just go to festivals with random alternate medicine crap.
Actually, when we were at the Mind or Body, Soul, and Spirit Expo last year, there was a guy there who was selling frying pans and making crepes on them. So I guess turnabout is fair play.
You know, actually, it's funny, too, because I was noticing at the SkyTrain the other day that Happy Valley, Happy Earth, Earth Happy, I'm not sure who it is, so they can't sue us, were handing out free samples of stuff that were immune boosters and liver clean detox things, which were supposed to detox your liver and make it function better. And these immunity, which will help prevent colds and flus. And I'm going, no, it won't. But it was free, so I took them anyhow.
Now, what's interesting is that some spices and extracts and things that are used to flavor or cook with do actually have antibacterial effects. I remember when I was taking an ethnobotany course in my final year here at UBC, we did an experiment where every group did extracts from things like mint or turmeric or whatever and dropped them onto various types of bacteria, and we let them grow for a while, and we saw later that they were actually keeping bacteria from growing onto them, or in some cases even killing them, the entire plate.
In fact, actually, I remember listening or reading something from an ethnobiologist who was pointing out that's one of the reasons why, as you tend to get closer to the equator, you tend to have more and more spicy foods, because spice becomes a preservative. As you get farther away to the north, you can rely more on climate and other sources of that. That's what he said.
That's a really cool theory. I like that.
Yeah.
But we're not going to be talking about healthy food or bullshit food today. We're going to be talking about unhealthy food and its effects based on economic decision-making. But more on that later.
Speaking of healthy foods and foods, if I can interrupt now, I saw something really interesting in The Economist. Yes, even I listen to The Economist. You need to know what the enemy's doing. But on The Economist, they were having this thing. They were talking about this new robotic entity called EATR, E-A-T-R. Weird acronym, but and it stands for something really stupid, but they were going for the hook. Anyhow, this is supposed to be an autonomous robot that goes out and does, you know, scans the bushes of Afghanistan or the borders or go through forests, and it has the ability to fuel itself. And I went, whoa, cool, it can fuel itself. This sounds really interesting. And then I listened to it and I did a bit more, and apparently it's a throwback to what they call steampunk, you know, this old Victorian-type technology that's done advanced. What it does is has little arms and little cutters that cuts the grass or clutch plants, puts it into a little fuel cell that burns it, makes steam, and runs the power thing.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I mean, part of me is going, this is really cool, and then again, well, wait a minute, what's so fantastic about this? But
so we have a shortage of, you know, food for humans. So they say, okay, let's build a robot that also eats food.
Well, it's eating grass. Most humans don't eat grass.
But wouldn't it be more...
No, think of it this way.
But our food eats grass.
Think of it this way. It will cut your grass and eat your grass, so you don't have to pay for, like, fuel or the cost of someone else doing it. You just send the eater out onto your lawn, and it does everything for you.
So it'd be a great lawnmower, then.
I don't know. Maybe I'm with Ethan on this one, because one of the things he said they could do is that the Forestry Society can use this to go out and monitor, you know, the health of the planet or make sure there's no poaching. But, you know, if it goes out there and it's chopping down the trees to fuel itself, isn't that becomes a self-defeating purpose? But yeah, no, it sounded really interesting. In fact, the guy who was doing this, who was a representative from the company, was saying there's been a few false news items about it where it's supposed to eat organic material, and there are some horror stories, apparently, this may be related to what some other people have heard, maybe it's separate, of battlefield robots going out and eating the corpses of the enemy.
That actually was a news story a couple of months ago. There were some robotic companies that have contracts with the military that were talking about creating robots that would basically, you know, eat decomposing biological matter to fuel themselves while on the battlefield. And that conjures up these terrifying images of robots crawling around devouring the corpses of the fallen.
Not knowing exactly where the technology will go, this guy ruled that out by saying, well, actually, animal meat is actually very poor burning, which is why when we say we're going to throw a shrimp on the barbie, we mean to eat, not to add to the fire. And it's just not a very good burning material. But I thought it was interesting, too, just to add some nuance to this, is I haven't heard this story in any of my science. This was in The Economist. I heard it. And then I went to their website, and I find that they're looking for more funding to, they've done sort of a test of concept, and now they want to come out and start doing prototypes and production,
okay.
So they're kind of fishing for some money.
That's so why I haven't actually heard of it in any academic journals, because
yeah.
It doesn't exist.
Well, when I read the story, it looked to me like they were trying to build some kind of futuristic Terminator-esque robot that eats grass, which...
Seems a shame, really.
Seems a bit, I don't know, kind of on side.
Does that mean the flying one will smoke grass? Yeah, sorry.
Fear Skynet.
Yes. Well, We have a great show today. We've already mentioned that we're going to be talking a lot about food. Before we get to that, we have an interview with Jeff Wegg of the JREF. And those who are in the know will know that the JREF stands for the James Randi Educational Foundation, and they're putting on TAM this year, which also those in the know will know that that means the amazing meeting. So we'll get to that right after this commercial break.
Listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Now on Radio Free Thinker is Jeff Wegg. Jeff is the Communications and Outreach Coordinator for the JREF. He's also one of the major organizers of the Amazing Meeting and co-host of the weekly radio program and podcast Rational Alchemy. Jeff, welcome to Radio Free Thinker.
Thank you very much for having me.
So tell us, how did you come to be a skeptic?
Wow. Does one come to be a skeptic, or does one just realize that they're a skeptic? Honestly, I don't know. I don't know whether I was born this way or if it was part of my upbringing, but I do remember some very early life experiences where I was in church and asking questions that weren't supposed to be asked, and I did so to such an extent that I was actually asked to be taken out of CCD, which is the Catholic training for kids, and I've never gone back.
Interesting. So did that lead you toward working with the JREF?
I found out about the JREF through Randy's works. In high school, I had read his seminal book, Flim Flam, and so I knew of Randy. And one day while I was attending Georgetown University, I was an adult student there, I found a copy of the magazine Skeptic, which is published by the Skeptic Society in California. And there was an ad in there for this thing called the Amazing Meeting. This would have been the Amazing Meeting 2, the very first one in Vegas. And Penn and Teller were going to be there and a bunch of other people that I had always wanted to meet. And I thought, well, I like Vegas. Why not go? So I went, and it changed my life, literally. It was the first time I had ever felt like I was among my own kind, like I could say what I wanted without fear of repercussions. And a few years later, I actually started working for the JREF, and here I am now.
That's pretty awesome. Let's talk about the Amazing Meeting and your role in organizing it. First of all, what is the Amazing Meeting?
The Amazing Meeting is an international conference on critical thinking and skepticism. It is to celebrate the work of James Randi and also celebrate us, the attendees, the people there, to recognize the contributions we can make to the world and to discuss ways in which we can do it more effectively. So it is... It isn't just a series of boring lectures. There's an incredible amount of camaraderie. It's almost like a revival, more than anything else. That's probably the best model for it, although it certainly isn't religious. It's really hard to describe in terms of other events because I've never been to anything quite like it.
Okay, and what can attendees expect at the 8th TAM, which is happening when, did you say?
It is July 8th through 11th at the South Point Casino in Las Vegas. And while this is the 8th official TAM, it is actually the 10th TAM to take place because we had a mini TAM and there was a TAM in London last year. But this is the 8th official TAM. And attendees can expect to find 1,000 or more like-minded people all in the same room. And for many of us, that's a unique experience. During the days, we will listen to lectures from people such as Richard Dawkins, Phil Plait, DJ Grothy, James Randi, Carol Tavris, Jennifer Michael Hecht, Massimo Filiucci. Even a lot of the CFI folks will be there, Paul Kurtz and Barry Carr and Ben Radford and many others. Michael Shermer will be there. We get to hear these folks speak. In addition to that, we get to have lunch with many of the celebrities and many of us, and we get to share experiences. It's one of the few places I feel comfortable just going and sitting at a table of strangers and saying, hey, may I sit here? And then 15 minutes later, you're in a deep conversation about the philosophy of science or how people don't believe in homeopathy. How people do believe in homeopathy even after you explain to them how it works, because nobody could ever believe that, so you must be lying to them. All that type of thing. In the evenings, we have shows by magicians and other performers, and there are many unofficial gatherings, lots of parties, pub crawls. It's endless activity. One of the things that is an in-joke about Tam is that sleeping is not for Tam. You don't sleep at Tam. You just go. And then you crash for the next week. Unfortunately, I have to work, so I miss out on an awful lot of this. And I actually do try to get about 3 hours of sleep a night during TAM. But it's a celebration more than anything. It is a conference. There's a lot of education involved. We have 8 different workshops on a wide variety of topics. But above all, it is a celebration of skepticism and a way to connect with like-minded people.
So you've mentioned connecting with people of a like mind and being in an atmosphere where people are likely to agree a lot. But will you find different interpretations of what it means to be a skeptic at the Amazing Meeting?
Oh, sure. We're not without controversy, and that's part of the fun. There are many different political backgrounds, and there's even different religious backgrounds. It's a common assumption that skepticism equals atheism, but if you come to the Amazing Meeting, you'll find many skeptics who are actually believers in one form of God or another, and it's fine. It's all open for discussion and debate. There are some hot-button issues, and we're going to explore some of those in depth this year. One is global warming. What is the skeptic's responsibility regarding the global warming theory? And we are going to have a panel this year and discuss that in depth. So it is certainly not the case that you're in a room of people who are all in lockstep opinion. The thing that binds us all together is that we all have a great love for the truth, and we're willing to reconsider our own ideas in pursuit of the truth. So definitely come with an open mind, but also be prepared for people to challenge your beliefs. That's part of the process.
Excellent. So you've been to a lot of skeptical conferences. You've helped organize them.
Yes.
What do you like to see out of a skeptical conference? What makes them successful?
There's many different measures for success. Of course, you know, the JREF's a nonprofit, so we depend on this for some income. There's that level. We've grown every year, and I count that as a level of success. Our first conference was 150, and we've been this will be our second year that we've been over 1,000, which I think is great. But to me, the biggest marker of success is how happy people are afterwards. There's a phenomenon called the TAM high, which is that after you've come to TAM, for the next week, you're just floating on air, all excited about skepticism and about all the people you've met and how there's hope for the future. That, to me, if we can pull that off year after year, is all we need to do to be successful.
Excellent. How do you feel about skeptical conferences like TAM fitting in with the notion of skepticism 2.0?
Skepticism 2.0 is an interesting idea. This year, we are going to explore it a bit because that's closely associated with the grassroots movement. And this year, we have a grassroots panel and a grassroots workshop. And the JREF is exploring ways in which it can be sort of a mother hen organization for some of these grassroots efforts where we can provide resources to help them get started. So we do not see grassroots and skepticism 2.0 as a competition to us. We see it as something that we're going to embrace and help foster, and it will definitely be addressed at TAM this year.
That sounds great. You know how a lot of days people have access to a community online, and it connects them across vast distances. So how would you like to see technology and the internet be used for conferences and skepticism in general?
Well, the JREF is an internet organization, and that's really how the JREF gets its word out primarily. We started in 1996, right as the internet was taking a foothold, and almost all of our activities have some online component. The first Amazing Meeting was largely a product of interest from our forum, which is at forums.randy.org, and that is no longer the case. The forum is still a big part of TAM, but TAM has grown well beyond that, and the way it's grown is through podcasts and blogs and all the other different internet media that people have access to. So we will have people live blogging TAM. We have a Twitter account for TAM. We have a Facebook account for TAM. The internet will be a big part of it.
And you've mentioned how TAM is expanding beyond just North America. You've also got a TAM coming up in Australia. You've had a TAM in London. Any other plans for expansion?
Well, there's been talk about TAM, another TAM in Europe. I don't know the details of that. It's still kind of too early. We do have another TAM London. In fact, tickets are going on sale in the U.S., what is Memorial Day weekend. That is coming up in October. So there is actually going to be three TAMs this year, all of which we expect to come close to selling out. So the TAM phenomenon is growing, although we will always continue to have our TAM in the U.S., and that will be our flagship TAM. Having these international TAMs is they're almost separate events in that they have a different audience and they have a different set of speakers, but they still have the same message. It's still a celebration of learning and truth.
Do you think that the TAMs in, say, America, North America, Canada, do you think they take on a different priority with the different levels of sort of scientific or skeptical awareness of the general public versus, say, in Europe or Australia?
Well, what we do with the TAMs, the foreign TAMs, you know, Australia and the UK, is we tailor them to the audiences that live there. The US TAM is in Vegas, and there's nothing more American than Vegas, I suppose. And such an environment may not go over well in the UK. And they have different problems in the UK. Their quote-unquote woo-woo is focused a little differently than ours is. So we do tailor the events to that. In fact, we have people from those countries actually directly involved with the planning of TAM. I'm sort of the U.S. TAM planner, where we have other people in the other countries customizing those events to those regions. Although they certainly would appeal to anyone from any country. You know, there's nothing that specific about it. They are a little different, though. The Vegas TAM definitely has some Vegas flavor in it. The TAM UK event, which is in London, feels more like London. It's a little bit, perhaps a little bit more serene. And TAM Australia, this is our first one. I'm not sure what to expect there, but I expect it to be a little bit raucous.
Interesting. Sounds pretty awesome. How can people register and sign up for TAM?
TAM, for the U.S., registration is open right now. You can go to randi.org, randi.org, and you'll see a banner right on the front page. It says Amazing Meeting 2010. We're trying to throw the year in there to make it clear to people what year the event's happening. If you click on that link, you'll see all the information for TAM, who's speaking, what events there are, and also is a registration button that will take you to the process of registering, which you can do all online. You can pay with a credit card, you can send us a check, or if you have to, my phone number is buried in there, and you can call me and I'll take it over the phone with you.
Excellent. Well, Jeff, thanks so much for joining us on Radio Free Thinker and telling us all about TAM. And when I'm down there, hopefully we'll get to chat some more.
Absolutely. I would love that. And thank you very much for this opportunity. I'll see everyone at TAM.
So long, Jeff.
Bye-bye.
CITR has more friends than ever before. We've partnered with tons of local businesses to bring you great discounts in the communities where you live, work, and play. Maybe Main Street is your main drag. Present your Friends of CITR card at Red Cat Records, Lucky's Comics, Devil May Wear, Thriller, Blim, The Kiss Store, The Wallflower Modern Diner, RX Comics, Antisocial Skateboard Shop, Vinyl Records, Regional Assembly of Text, and Twig and Hottie to receive fabulous discounts. So become a CITR member, get a free friends card, and feel the love.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker. Now, I washed my hands today, and I felt pretty good about that.
Well, actually, that's a good point. Everyone should kind of feel good about that, or so a study might say.
They might say.
Well, there was a study released recently by, and I'm not making this up, Spike S.W. Lee. No, not the famous black producer. Although in almost every interview I heard with this guy, everyone says, so you're not the producer, director guy, are you? And of course, you could hear the guy going, Jesus. But no, so this guy Spike Lee did a study checking to see what response hand washing does. He was quite interested in how there's so many metaphors, you know, wiping the slate clean, I wash my hands of this, and he wanted to see, is there something maybe more to it than just cultural significance? So he did a test where he told people to make a choice between going on a holiday in Paris or going on a holiday in Rome. And the control group made the choice, and then afterwards they said, well, what do you think about your choice? Do you think it was a good choice or not? And you have something that's called, what's it called? Choice bias, right? Where after you make a choice, you have to sit there and you have to justify your choice,
you
right?
You stick with it, basically.
Right.
Post-decision dissonance?
Kind of thing, yeah. Actually, you used the word cognitive dissonance, but I don't think that was an appropriate term. I think your post-decision was better. But the idea is, you know, you're going to try and point out all the really good things about the thing you chose and try and emphasize all the bad things you did. But he did a study. He said after you made a choice, then he had some people wash their hands and some people didn't. And after you washed your hands, you didn't show this this post-choice bias that apparently you said, well, I made my choice and who cares? And so there was a cut between the sense of, or he interprets this as a cut between the sense of responsibility for your actions after you've washed your hands. You no longer have this instinctual tie to justify your choices. I did it, washed my hands of it, literally as well as metaphorically, which I thought was kind of interesting. There was some problems with the study. One, it wasn't a huge number. I haven't been able to find the exact number, but it was a small study. And two, he only ran the test sort of once per person, so there's the possibility that there's certain individual biases that are coming into this. And again, I mean, you know, do you think that was a valid test of, you know, am I morally free of my decisions once I've washed my hands?
Well, is it just the washing of the hands? Could it be anything? Could it be like, you know, picking up a Rubik's Cube for 15 seconds?
Right. They did do tests like that where they used other distractors.
Mm-hmm.
The only one that had any noticeable effect were like hand wipes, damp wipe-ems. And again, there's sort of water in that, so that was why they figured maybe that's the metaphor still holding on. But no, doing any other kind of thing didn't seem to affect this.
How did they get the people to wash their hands? Did they just kind of nonchalantly say, could you please wash your hands on the way out, or?
No, it was part of the protocol. So you were told, you're going to ask this question, right? Then do task A. And task A sometimes is nothing. Sometimes it was washing hands. Sometimes it was doing some other distractive. I forget what the distractive element was, but it was nothing to do with washing hands. And then they asked you a question afterwards. So although you knew you had done something, you didn't know what that something had to do with anything else.
It's an interesting study. I definitely want to see it replicated a little more before I put too much weight into it.
I did actually hear of a similar study. Maybe it was this study or it was one related to it. But the decisions that people had to make were rank ordering music preferences and how much they would pay for music, I think.
Okay.
I can't remember this exactly, but they found that people would find it difficult to subsequently rank order musical decision. Like they would basically, you know, I'd pay more for this one than for this one in the first round of the study. And then in the second round, they had a forced choice paradigm where they were forced to order them all. And people found it difficult to go against the decision they made in the first round. But if they'd washed their hands, it was almost like it was resetting the bias. So the decisions you made in the first round no longer biased the way you would order and rank them later. So I'm not sure that I buy the idea that a lot of headlines are saying that washing your hands gets rid of guilt or gets rid of remorse over past decisions. It's more like this act is associated with getting rid of the effects of the decision you made previously.
Maybe it somehow reduces your sense of ownership or buy-in to it. So you're not remorseless that I killed the person, but you may be saying, you know, I no longer own this. Well, yeah, I don't know. It's another thing too that wasn't well explained. This was the cultural diversity of the subject matters. So judging from the tone of conversation of Dr. Lee, it seemed to be very much of a Western sort of thing, and he would like to try it in different cultures, I believe. But he was going on, like I say, the whole idea of washing my hands of it, and, you know, clean slate, which are terms that are quite common in English and in Western cultures. I'm not sure what the equivalent would be in African or Chinese culture, and whether that would play into a different mechanism for removing one sense of justification for decisions past.
Interesting. Well, why don't we give our listeners a chance to wash their hands of this segment, and we go to commercial break, come back, and talk a bit about food.
Okay, hello, I'm Tim, again, Sarah Lepp, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker. So, Rob, you talked about going to the Vancouver food festival thing.
Yeah, to Eat Vancouver.
Right.
And so now that we've washed your hands, we're ready to eat.
Oh, that's very clever. So tell us about food.
So food has a massive influence in our everyday lives. We could spend hours talking about food, like, you know, preparation, eating it, the social aspects of food, the decisions we make around food.
We only have a half hour, though.
Well, what I've been interested in recently, and I've been compiling a bunch of stories for several months, actually, is this idea that food that is unhealthy can... your decisions that you make about unhealthy or healthy food can be manipulated by the cost of the food. And so the first thing that's sort of important to establish here is that, like, food that is widely available is in fact unhealthy. And there are loads and loads of studies that all talk about how, you know, high fructose corn syrup is bad for you, trans fats are bad for you, increased consumption of sugar is bad for you. Recently in the UK, doctors called for a complete ban on trans fats in all food available in the UK.
Does this also relate to sort of how, you know, McDonald's is like $5 for a burger and combo, but if I wanted to buy like a basket of fruit or vegetables, it's going to cost me like $8.
Yeah, there are a lot of things involved in this sort of unhealthy, healthy imbalance. You know, unhealthy food is cheaper, more widely available. There's more pressures to eat it. It's marketed more. There's all sorts of things contributing to what could be leading to a really unhealthy society. And Health Canada actually recently had a 2-year voluntary program for food companies in Canada to voluntarily reduce the number of trans fats in their food. And at the end of this period, which was just very recently, they found that it wasn't enough, especially with prepackaged baked goods, cookies, croissants, cakes, things like that, still have way too many trans fats to be considered healthy. And so now they're calling for regulation. And the government actually, when they started this 2-year program, said that if people didn't reduce it enough at the end of it, they would be calling for regulation of trans fats, perhaps a total ban like the doctors in the UK are calling for now.
So the question that immediately comes to mind is, the government is threatening to step in. Is the science indicating that we need the government to step in? Is it this bad for us? Are we in such a bad position that we need strict regulation on trans fats?
There's been a couple of high-profile studies that have all looked at how unhealthy additions to food have effects on public health or risk factors for obesity or heart attack or things like that. There was one very recently on high fructose corn syrup. And for people who don't know that, high fructose corn syrup is a sugar replacement that is really easy to use. And it's actually incredibly popular in soft drinks because it comes in a liquid form. You can just stir it in and voila, you have a sweetened pop or whatever. And it differs from sucrose, which is the everyday table sugar that you find, you know, at home, in that sucrose has an equal amount of fructose and glucose, but high fructose corn syrup has an increased proportion of fructose to
Hence
glucose.
Hence the name.
Yeah, high fructose corn syrup. And it's made from corn, as the name suggests.
From what I understand, too, another advantage to it is that when you put it in things, because it's not a crystalline structure, it makes things softer. So you get the sweetness in there, but, you know, your chewy cookies, part of the reason why they're chewy is you've got this fructose in there that allows for it to be more malleable, and it's better for processing things. It's simpler to use.
Yeah, and so all these things contribute to its use, but studies have been finding that high fructose corn syrup is a huge contributor to obesity problems. Study after study is finding that, there was a longitudinal study that looked at the introduction of high fructose corn syrup to the food supply in America, and it pretty much coincides exactly with the rise of obesity, the obesity epidemic, really, in America. And another recent study was finding in rat studies where they would give high fructose corn syrup, make it available to one group of rats, and make regular sugar water to another group. And the high fructose corn syrup group ended up getting fatter in the same amount of time as the regular group. Although there were some methodological difficulties with this study, but you know, each individual study has its methodological problems, but in the aggregate, it seems to point to pretty good evidence that HFCS contributes to obesity on a very large scale.
Okay, so the science is pretty much established in that area then. The question then becomes, do we want the government to decide that, you know, certain ingredients are off limits, or is that the role of the consumer?
I'll step into this one because obviously everyone will probably know my take on this. The whole point of government is to protect the citizens from industry, from dangers to it. And if there's a failing somehow in the marketplace to provide this protection, that's an excellent time for governments to step in and say, listen, we've tried to do this voluntarily. It's not working. This is not only bad for the individual, but it's bad for society, any country that has socialized health medicine. This has an effect on everyone. So going in and stepping in and saying at least we need to regulate it, if not ban it, I think is a very appropriate step for them to do. How radical it goes, that's a secondary question. But it's right to do so, I think, is more than apparent, especially considering, if I understood you correctly, there was this grace period where they said, well, let's see if we can do this all voluntarily. Let's see if we can, you know, do this without regulations. And that failed horribly.
Yeah, there are similar programs in the states as well. I think New York is a state that tries these kinds of food reforms quite a lot, and there was a period of voluntary salt removal in their foods, but they found that that isn't working. So they've been calling for you know, a ban on salt. There was actually very recently a front page New York Times article about this sort of declaring all-out war on salt in the food supply, and the salt institutes and food companies reply to this call.
I read that article. It was very interesting. They were talking about how that in most foods, a certain level of salt is actually needed for the food, not just to have the right taste, but the right texture, and actually just hold together physically. Without a certain amount of salt, it will literally just fall apart.
Yeah, it's actually kind of scary when you think about it, but the way a lot of mass-produced food is made, salt is not just used for flavoring, it's used as a binding agent. It's used to keep the food together, it's used to give it texture so that it isn't a sort of smooth paste. It's used, in some cases, to give it any flavor at all. It's used to hide bitter flavors that are used in the refining process of some of the less natural ingredients that go into mass-produced food.
Of course, some of the blowback from this, though, is that one of the reasons why they use salt isn't because it needs to be there to hold it together, but the alternatives are more expensive. And we were talking before about how poor quality food is also cheap food. And one of the reasons why it's cheap is salt, well, it's a rock. There's lots of it in the planet. It's really easy to get a hold of. So instead of going for higher quality ingredients or something, let's just throw in a little salt. I mean, one of the examples that I'd used was with regards to pasta, and that non-salt pasta has to use a higher quality of herbs and better tomatoes because it doesn't have the salt in there to bring out the flavor, and that costs a bit more money. And one of the claims that the industry says, listen, we just can't afford to do it healthy.
There's definitely a well-established link between poverty and eating lots of these unhealthy additives to food, like high fructose corn syrup and all those things, because it is true, people who don't have a lot of money to spend it on food aren't going to spend it on expensive but decent for you alternatives. They're going to buy the cheap candy bars that have tons of calories for almost no cost.
Well, there's actually another thing, because I was just listening to analysis on the BBC, and they had this one gentleman who was, I believe, called The Equality Level. I can't remember the exact name of the article book he wrote, but he pointed out that in places where there's a lot of inequality, you also tend to get a lot of obesity because of the idea of insecurity. And everyone knows food is a comfort item. If you're feeling nervous or something, you eat a bit of food and it has a salutary effect on the body. So not only do poor people eat more because the food is that, but poor people tend to be more at risk of bad things happening, losing my job, getting kicked out of my house, which tends to make them eat even more than they might have otherwise, or at least that's what this one gentleman mentioned.
Not to mention less access to, gyms and exercise and healthy lifestyle choices that more affluent people have access to.
Hmm. Well, just on the subject of whether governments should regulate salt input in particular, there was a review in the Lancet, the esteemed British medical journal, that looked at a lot of different studies about salt reduction and health over a very long period of time. And they found that a 15% reduction in salt consumption worldwide would result in basically the prevention of 9 million deaths over the next 20 years or so.
The only question I have with that study, though, is, I mean, people who eat a lot of salt probably also eat a lot of other unhealthy foods. So can we put it clearly on salt, or can we put it more on, like, well, if you eat lots of salt, you're likely to eat a lot of other, high...
I think that the studies they were looking at controlled for things like that. They controlled for lifestyle choices and age and all that sort of weight matching and stuff, and basically found that it was the addition of extra salt to the diet that resulted in increased health risk, and removal of salt resulting in lower health risk.
Even another issue, though, is, let's say salt gets taxed, so people have to pay more money to do it, and that's the way salt use is reduced. Who's to say the people eating salt aren't just going to move on to something else that's unhealthy? That's one of the biggest issues with some of these studies that I've seen, where they've raised taxes on, let's say, sodas. People just go to other things that aren't very healthy.
Well, I think that leads us directly into the other issue, is partly why is this stuff so cheap? And part of it is the subsidies, agricultural subsidies and all that, that a lot of these, I mean, corn is one of the most heavily subsidized industry in the United States. Beef and cow production, heavily subsidized. Whereas things like broccoli, because George Bush Sr. didn't like broccoli, is hardly subsidized at all, right? So one of the alternatives people could go to is maybe fresh fruit, fresh vegetables, healthier choices, if the agricultural subsidy system was rejiggered to promote healthy food instead of the food it currently is.
Yeah, just to give you some magnitudes on that, in the U.S., since 1995, there have been over $73 billion of corn subsidies, over $30 billion for wheat, about $30 billion for cotton. You have to go all the way down on this list of subsidies to get to the healthiest looking thing I've seen, which is apples, which comparatively have only gotten $261 million. So that is just, it's such a tiny fraction, and almost nothing on here is that great for you.
And I note that apples are the only thing on this list that doesn't look like it ends up becoming either sugar or oil.
Well, and let's not forget, apples are turned into apple juice, and apple juice is one of the sweeteners that's used in a lot of products, it and grape juice. If you ever look at anything that's like a juice or something, and you look at one of the sweeteners, one of the alternatives they use to sugar is apple juice or grape juice, which...
And that's really just because they don't have to call it sugar, because it's fructose instead.
You know, I love broccoli, and I think that, if we helped it out a bit more, I think it could be really catch on as a...
Well, that's one thing that people are saying, is that one of the reasons people eat so unhealthily is it's not just because these things are so readily available and cheap, but they're hugely marketed. I mean, here's some statistics. In the U.S., almost a third of children are overweight. Two-thirds of adults are overweight to the point of being obese. What's the culprit? Well, the Public Health Nutrition Journal thinks it's marketing. So as one example, they found that in 2006 to 2008, there was a 97% increase in the use of cartoons, toys, and movie marketing tie-ins to market unhealthy food to children.
Well, on that note, let's go to a commercial break on Radio Free Thinker, and we'll be back with more about food and marketing.
The state of hip-hop right now, man, as far as the way I see it, I think right now, hip-hop is advancing as far as skills. You got brothers, you know what I'm saying, getting, like, more witty.
There ain't nobody to be pretty for. Let it rattle, let the clatter kill him, let the cataclysm wash. Who really listens? Precision with a verse draws a cry. Draw a line between an easy melody and peace of mind.
Uh-huh. You got DJs doing all kind of crazy shit on the turntables. I like where it's going, and I like, you know what I'm saying, the creative process that brothers is trying to take it to right now.
Rally Rails and Bread and Butter in the place to be. Crimes and Treasons Radio, 101.9 FM, Vancouver, CITR.ca, every Tuesday, 9 till 11.
Dynamite!
CITR 101.9 FM is proud to support the Vancouver Area Cycling Coalition's Bike to Work Week from May 31st to June 6th. Join thousands of others cycling and celebrating. Bike to Work Week encourages people to try biking to work and celebrates with those that already do. During the week, visit commuter stations to enjoy free food, drinks, bike maps, bike maintenance, and fabulous prizes. You can win a new bike for recruiting the most coworkers to join your team or for recording your commute online. There's a bike a day giveaway just for logging your commute. To register and track your progress online, visit biketoworkmetrovan.ca.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker talking about food and the possible taxation of said food.
So given that a lot of studies seem to show that it's not just the ingredients, but the actual unhealthy foods and the wide availability and cheapness of them that's contributing to public health problems, some people are saying that we could tax these foods, the really unhealthy foods, and that this would lead to better public health. And here's the basic idea behind it. It's kind of a 12-step process. Number one, we like sugar. We've evolved to really like sugar. Now that sugar is really widely available, our, you know, long evolution time span hasn't had the chance to catch up with the fact that sugar is now widely available. And so we still crave it, we still eat it. And number two, overeating sugar leads to obesity. And so number three, there's an obesity problem because sugar is widely available, people keep eating it, and they get obese. So number four, we should reduce sugar consumption. That might reduce obesity. But number five, we really like sugar. Like, we're not going to change purely for rational health reasons. You know, people put up information all the time about this is unhealthy. People still do it. People still smoke cigarettes even when there's massive warnings about that it's going to kill you and give you horrible teeth and etc. So, number six, if you hit our pockets, we're going to reduce our consumption because economic decisions is something that we do all the time and it is something that we've evolved to deal with. So number seven, hit our pockets, sugary drink consumption will go down if you're doing like a soda pop tax. Then number eight, the markets opens up. More types of drinks are coming on. More healthy types of drinks are coming up. So number nine, our soda dependence, our sugary soda dependence will drop as there's more healthy alternatives that are about the same cost. Number 10, our sugar consumption drops. Number 11, obesity drops. And number 12, the healthcare costs of the obesity also drop. So that's the basic idea behind taxing unhealthy foods.
So if I could just sort of maybe poll our expert panel here, I assume that everyone here has from time to time indulged in some McDonald's or Burger King. Would you guys be less likely to eat it if the price went up a couple bucks?
Well, I guess, yeah, I'm a cheap person, so I would go down. But I think the caveat here is, if the one item became cheaper, might I just go for something that is higher in fat if it was not, you know, I mean, if given the choice between sugary cookies or fatty chips, I might choose the fatty chips now because I can't afford the cookies anymore. You know what I mean? Like, so the fact that the one is more expensive would mean I'm less likely to buy it, but that doesn't necessarily mean I'm going to buy something healthy in its stead.
Well, what about you, Rob? Would you be less likely to buy McDonald's if it was more expensive?
Well, I mean, I'm sort of biased in this situation. I haven't eaten McDonald's in years. I tend not to go to fast food at all. I mean, as I said at the top of the show, I'm a total foodie. I cook for myself at every available opportunity, and I've sort of, you know, been indoctrinated into liking the idea of fresh food, fresh ingredients, and cooking for myself. So, you know, I can't really say much on this, but based from my knowledge from cognitive psychology and behavioral economics, I do know, and I'm going to mention some studies in a little bit, that taxing unhealthy food does encourage people to choose healthier alternatives.
As a foodie, do you actually look at the ingredients of stuff you buy to find out what's the sodium content, what's the fat content?
Definitely. I tend not to buy things that have really long ingredients lists if I can avoid it. I mean, there's a sort of easy mnemonic you can use to shop healthier at the grocery store. Avoid the middle of the aisles. All the good stuff is on the outside, and all the bad stuff is inside the aisles.
Interesting. What about you, Daniel?
I'm sure if the tax was high enough, it would have some effect. Like Don was saying, though, it really depends on what your alternatives are. If, I just had pizza before doing the radio show here, which isn't the greatest thing for me, but what else am I going to get here in the student union building? There isn't a lot of healthy choices. So I might move from pizza to Subway, but depending on what you get there, it might not be super healthy.
So I think we're kind of saying that, you know, if we do tax it, you would also probably need to subsidize healthy food. But I think one of the other dangers of taxation, I mean, I love taxation, especially if it hits rich people more than poor. But the one thing about this, though, is then you start turning these items into luxury goods. And people in our culture, anyhow, have a craving for luxury goods. You know, we want to, I know I'm doing better because now I can afford the fatty piece of meat. You know, I mean, we're going to get a thing where you know, back in the olden days, one of the signs of being a prosperous person was being obese because you could afford more food than other people could. Are we going to somehow maybe engender that into society that you can afford to have the really sugary, sweet Coke and not the diet healthy Coke?
I kind of doubt that. we have enough, like, signs of superfluous signs of wealth in our society that I don't think we really need another one.
Well, I mean, it might suddenly make it a sign of, like, a classy date to go to McDonald's and go to the fancy French restaurant.
That would be horrible. It's like a nightmare dystopian future, I'm imagining. Well, there's a really cool study that might shed some light on this question. The Archives of Internal Medicine reports on this really long, large-scale longitudinal study with over 5,000 young adults aging, I think, 18 to 35. They tracked various statistics of their health and their lifestyle from 1985 to 2005 and compared this data with food price data over the same period of time. And they found that, in general, a 10% increase of food prices was associated with a 7% decrease in caloric intake, for example, of soda, or a 12% decrease in caloric intake of pizza. So the prices of food do have measurable and standard effects on your caloric intake of unhealthy foods. So some places in the States actually have already started taxing foods. Chicago, for example, I believe has a soda tax. New York has tabled legislation on it. California is trying to do it. Philadelphia has some.
Those are all places where I always picture, like, you know, a New York style pizza or, you know, a Philadelphia cheesesteak sandwich. I mean, like, I don't want to pay more when I go to those places to get those foods.
Most of them are taxing soda, though, not the other things.
Yeah. Of course, now you're bringing up another thing. I don't know if Rob's going to go there, but if you do trans fats and then you do high fructose sugar, then what's next on the list? And I don't believe in the slippery slope, but I'm sure someone's going to bring up the slippery slope. You know, is this an infinite list of things?
There is definitely a trick in finding out what will have the largest effect with the minimum amount of regulation necessary. There's another journal, Health Affairs, that looked at the early childhood longitudinal study, which is it's for the past many, many years. I'm not even sure how long it's been going on now, but it's been tracking health data, lifestyle data, all sorts of data points on a very large amount of children for pretty much their entire lives. And they're comparing it to taxation info on things like soda in various states. And what they found is that small taxes don't work. They found that, in general, taxes on things ranged from around 3.5%. The maximum was 7%. That, at this level, taxation has almost significant effects. It has some significant effects in cafeterias where prices get rounded up. But, in general, if you want to change, you're going to need to do something that actually does make a difference, that it does hit the wall enough that people will want to change. Especially since
What are you trying to say?
Sorry, someone fill in the data. I was flipping through my notebook here because I found another study where, so New York has been doing something where they've been labeling nutritional information on their restaurant menus. So this is an alternative that some people have come up with to taxation, that putting giving the consumers information about the nutritional content of the food that they can decide to buy will allow them to make their own decisions rather than changing the price points so that the decisions will be forced on them.
I like the idea of the standardized labeling, and I think it has to be somewhat standardized, because if you look at an ingredients list, you look at that. I was looking at one of the articles, and it was telling you about the salt, but the actual idea of salt was in like seven different words. It was all salt, but different forms of salt. But if you read it as a consumer, you probably wouldn't know this. So standardized format. But you wouldn't talk about taxes. What about just standard regulation?
It's a good question. Just a note on this study. So the CDC head, Dr. Tom Friedman, who was the former New York Health Commissioner that helped New York set up this labeling policy in all their restaurants, basically found that the labeling effect works, but it is incredibly sensitive to economic decisions. So if a food was unhealthy but a lot cheaper than the healthy choice, people would go for it, even if the nutritional information was up there and there was a massive, obvious, significant difference in how healthy one was over the other. So the usual response of, well, if you put the information up there, consumers can make their own decisions, this study at least suggests that, well, no, people's economic decision making is going to take over.
Well, so very fascinating information there. I encourage our listeners to email us with their thoughts and opinions at radio.freethinker@gmail.com. We're almost out of time, so let's go to our skeptical highlights. Does anyone have a skeptical highlight for our listeners this week?
I have just a short one, and it's actually reiterating the one I said last week, recommending the book The Good Man Jesus and the Scoundrel Christ by Philip Pullman. Now, last week it was based on a recommendation from a friend. I've read the book since, and actually it's quite good. You have to really wait till the last chapter to get the dig on it, but it's actually quite good. I found it quite enjoyable.
I'll have to look up that up. I have a highlight as well. I'm sure many listeners know that on Friday, June 4th, our old pal Deepak Chopra will be in Vancouver to spread his anti-science crap. And CFI is encouraging Vancouver skeptics and freethinkers to make a stand on the pseudoscience. At 5 p.m., CFI volunteers will meet at the Vancouver Public Library to make some quick plans, and then at 6 p.m. head over to the Queen Elizabeth Theatre to hand out flyers, encouraging people to think critically about what Chopra is going to be saying at his talk. We're going to be there from 6 p.m., which is when the room opens for the VIPs, and then at 7 p.m. when it opens to the general public. So we're going to be there for a while handing out flyers and just, you know, offering a scientific point of view to the people who are going to pay lots of money to see Deepak Chopra. We have a Facebook event, and we're going to link to it in the show notes. And if anyone has any questions or comments, you can address them there. It's going to be really interesting, and I encourage you to come out. Any other skeptical highlights?
Yeah, the UBC Freethinkers are starting up a monthly breakfast called the Breakfast of Champions. The first one will be June 10th, which is a Thursday, at 10:30 a.m. at the King's Head, 1618 U Street. You can find more information at our Facebook page. Come out for a good breakfast with lots of good skeptical people.
Hopefully it's going to be more than just a bowl of Wheaties.
Hopefully.
Well, remember to eat healthy at the breakfast.
Wednesday, which is tomorrow as of airtime, on June 2nd at 6 p.m. at the Vancouver Police Museum, they're putting on a demonstration and lecture or class of forensic science. So you'll get to, if you show up, all sorts of fun with blood spatter analysis and things like that. So it'd be really cool.
But don't forget to behave yourself, because they might also have a demonstration of tasers there, too.
Don't do that. Okay, well, we're out of time. So this is Ethan, your free-thinking historian and executive director of CFI Vancouver, saying goodnight.
This is Don saying eyes open, minds on.
This is Rob with some food for thought. It is currently more cost-efficient in Florida to let fresh, ripe strawberries rot in the ground than to pay anyone to pick them.
Wow. Good to know. This is Daniel saying thanks for listening.